Hello, everyone. My name is Devin Rue. I'm a professional fantasy cartographer and illustrator in the tabletop RPG industry, as well as your host for the Quip and Quill podcast.
My name is Tyler Walpole. I am an illustrator in the comics and games industry. I've been doing stuff for many, many years. I've worked for Marvel Studios, I've worked for Critical Role, I've worked on Dungeons & Dragons. Magic the Gathering is kind of my main gig these days. I've been around a block, done some stuff. And I do comics now. I'm working on a Critical Role graphic novel for Dark Horse currently. I'm literally working that as we talk.
Do you do this full-time?
I do this full-time.
How long have you been doing it full-time?
I started doing it part-time around 2000, and then probably 2007, 2008 is when I started doing it full-time, I think.
Okay.
Yeah. So my wife was working full-time. She finished school and had a full-time job with insurance and stuff. So that's what enabled me to make that leap. So
right.
without her having the situation that she had, I wouldn't have been able to go full-time at that point, but she did, so I was. And I had some lean years in there, but I stubbornly stuck with it until I made it work.
How long do you think that it took you from like when you started doing it full-time to your definition of success, because it is different for everyone, or when you felt at least that you were paying bills adequately enough?
Here's the thing. I had a couple of years in there where things were like, I had a couple of really good years. At one point I was doing a lot of work for Marvel, doing promotional material for their movies. So I would do like super high resolution renderings of Chris Evans' face in his Captain America costume. And you could get that. You could go buy that at Target or Kmart or whatever on, you know, everything from Beck school folders to swimming trunks or whatever.
Right.
And that was, I went from tabletop RPG money to advertising money. Mm-hmm. And that was a huge shift in my income. So, but I did that for like 2 years, and then they were just like, yeah, we don't have any more work for you. So my heart wasn't in it by the end. And I think it was showing in my work because there was no narrative in the illustrations we were doing. It was just do this character. And, the lighting was always the same, and yeah.
Right.
Anyway, it didn't engage my whole artist heart. And so anyway, like I said, they eventually didn't have more work for me. So, and I got back to focusing on gaming illustration, and that was a couple more years. And then once I started working for Magic about 5 years ago, six mm-hmm. years ago, things started getting a little bit better because the pay is better than a lot of tabletop role-playing game stuff.
Right.
And what really made the big shift for me was I saw what the collectibles market was for originals for Magic. Mm-hmm. And that was the first time in my career where it made it was a good financial decision for me to invest the time in learning how to do my digitally painted stuff, learning how to do it traditionally. So I spent the next few years learning how to do my work as oil paintings instead of as digital.
Right.
So that was really just like about 5 years ago. So it was a good 15 years of career before I went, okay, like I feel like a grown-up. I feel like I can make grown-up decisions with my money.
Right? I have adult money now.
Yeah.
How did you get started with Marvel?
So, when I was teenage Tyler, who's going to definitely pursue a career in art, I was for sure 100% going to become a comic book artist. I'm old, you guys. High school was in the early 90s for me. Comics were huge at that point. There was the 90s speculator boom. So there was kind of this thing where you could get paid to draw comics if you could hold a pencil. And so I was sure that's what I was going to go do. Well, right when I got out of high school and started pursuing my art career, like that whole bubble burst. So there was no comic book work really. I managed to get a little bit here and there. I gave up on that direction. And what I used to do is I would drive to comic book conventions and bring my portfolio and stand in line to talk to the editors, and they would look through it. I would get my, you need to work on your pacing or whatever. And so come back next year. Okay, I'll come back next year. So one year I decided, well, instead of doing that, I'm going to make a portfolio of tabletop RPG illustrations, just black and white. So it's all just, pen and ink work. And I'm going to go to Gen Con and show my portfolio around there. So I did the same thing as I did at a comic book convention. I walked around and I talked to every single publisher that I could find on the Gen Con floor. This is back when they were in Milwaukee instead of in Indiana. And I ended up talking to Palladium Books. They used to publish Rift. They still publish Rifts.
Right.
Which is their flagship RPG. The art director at the time was a guy named Scott Johnson. And Scott is who I talked to. I showed him my portfolio and he goes, "Oh, these are actually pretty cool. Let me get the boss over here." So he brought Kevin over, Kevin Sambita. So I got work with Palladium the very next week. Like literally he called me up and said, "Okay, we're going to get you rolling on some stuff." So I started working on the Palladium Fantasy RPG. I promise this gets to Marvel.
No, it's okay.
So Scott Johnson is the person that I can trace getting my foot in the door with in gaming illustration. He was the art director that got me my first yes.
Okay.
So then if you fast forward about 10 years, Scott at this point in his career is doing tons of Marvel characters for Marvel, like doing what I described earlier. So it's all the they call it the style guide for Marvel. Right. So if you're making products and you want to put Marvel characters on your product, they show you the style guide. And right. Which is full of a lot of Scott Johnson art for like a decade. He was exclusive with Marvel doing that stuff. So I ran into him at another convention. He lives in Chicago. I was there for C2E2 a bunch of years ago, and I showed him some of my current work, and I had what at the time I felt was like a cool X-Men piece that had, you know, like a dozen characters in it or something, and I showed that to him and I said, "You know, what do you think of that?" And he goes, "Oh man, you're playing in my wheelhouse now. This is really close to what I do." And I was like, "Well, if you guys ever need anybody, let me know."
Right.
And he said, and it was really lucky timing, because literally like 2 weeks later, his boss at Marvel said, "We've got too much stuff going on with the movie stuff coming in, so we need to get more people." So he said, "Do you know anybody?" And so Scott recommended me for there. So 10 years later, Scott got me in with Marvel. So there was lots and lots. So the first movie I worked on was, I did a couple Amazing Spider-Man pieces. But then it was Captain America Winter Soldier was the first one I did a lot of work on, and then went straight into Guardians of the Galaxy, which I remember working on those characters and kind of wincing at them. Like, I don't know, man. I don't know if this is how audiences are going to respond to these characters. And then I saw the first trailer for it, and I was so excited because it was so good.
It is funny because when I do talk about how art changes and how quickly the industry changes and everything else, I too used to walk around with a huge portfolio filled with my artwork and literally just like, please look at my stuff. Please look at my stuff. Please, please just look at it. You know, me and everyone else who ever, you know, wanted to get into, well, actually any form of art, because, you know, I did more traditional art when I very first started, forever ago as a teenager, and, was schlepping my stuff to galleries and trying to get an agent. And, so when I started doing art again, wanting to do it full time for the first time in my life, which was back in, 2010, 2011, it was the first time I was like, all right, I'm just gonna do art full time. 'Cause you know, I genuinely was prepared to do all of that all over again. And then I realized that that's not how that works anymore. And that almost all of it is over the internet, which is just mind-blowing to me.
There is still a lot to be said for if you can manage, and I know this sucks and it's not available to everybody, but if you can manage to put your body in the spaces where art directors are going to be, whether it's at a like an illustration workshop or a convention or something like that, 100% do it, because connecting with people in person just makes your email, it's like a force multiplier on its impact.
Yeah.
Because they get, you know, they might get 200 emails to look through in, I don't know, over what period of time that would be, but a short period of time.
Right.
And if one of them is from somebody that they've had a pleasant conversation with like a week ago, they'll probably open it and read it. And that'll help get you like a placeholder in their system, so they can be like, okay, we'll keep an eye on this person's work, right, or whatever.
Well, now there's so few people that are walking around with portfolios, you probably would stand out now. You know,
well, they just bring their iPad now.
Yeah, this is true.
It works, and it's a good, it's also good practice for any aspiring listeners or artists that are listening. It's really good practice to go around and try to get feedback from working artists as well. Because what I used to do, I would take notes, because I would do that as well. I would show it to editors, but I would also show my work to artists, and I would take a notepad along and I would write down their feedback. And what's really great is if you collect feedback from 15 people over the course of a weekend, you can go back and see where there's a consistent note, like, okay, I definitely need to work on this.
Right.
I definitely need to work on this. And then there'll be half of the things are scattershot, where only one person said that, that's a lot of it. But if you can find a common thread in there, that's like a good place to focus your efforts.
Yeah. And the other thing is that you definitely want to talk to other artists that are in the same realm of what you want to do.
For sure.
The amount of, and I love everyone who does this and it's great. And I understand because I also do other art, but I'm not a portrait artist. When I draw a portrait, it takes me a ridiculously long amount of time because I am definitely not a portrait artist at all. I do it like once every great while. So I'm not the person to ask. I will probably give you the worst advice on it. So definitely try and focus on people who kind of do about what you're looking for. You want it as varied as possible so you can get as many different viewpoints, but...
Yeah, it's always good to talk to people that are doing the work you want to do.
Yeah.
And the conversations with artists can also lead to work opportunities.
Absolutely.
Because, you know, we get asked to do things, and sometimes we have to say, no, my schedule is full. And they will say, do you know anybody? Can you recommend anybody? And sometimes I also get, you know, inquiries from people that, from companies that are kind of just getting started and maybe don't have the budget that work with what I'm doing. But I know people that are actively looking for work, and they're happy with those rates. So I will pass on names of people I know that have the chops. For one, that's the first thing. You have to have the skill set. And the other thing is, this whole industry, it's a marathon, not a sprint, right? So a lot of the people that you are in the marathon with, some of them are going to go, you know what? I would like to get a salary. I'm going to become an art director somewhere. So a lot of my artist friends that I was coming up with, they went, well, I'm out. I'm not going to do freelance art anymore, but I'm an art director at this company. Would you like to do some work? So that is a thing that happens.
Absolutely. And some of them just end up, even as freelancers, freelance art directors, freelance project managers, there's a lot to be said about making friends in this industry. And I'm going to stress this every single time that this comes up. You're out here to make friends. You're not out here just to make another rung on the ladder. So keep that in mind when you're talking to people. If the only thing that you kind of come forward with is like, how can I possibly use you to get what I want? You are not going to be recommended for projects. If the only time you talk to me is when you're like, hey, have you heard anything about any work needing to be done? I'm probably not going to recommend you.
On that note, this is the thing that I love the most about this industry, like specifically the like fantasy illustrators. There's not really that many jobs to go around, and there's a lot of people that want those jobs. There is every incentive for our industry to be like cutthroat and backstabby, but it's the exact opposite. There's this amazing thing where if you show up to like IluxCon and go, yeah, I want to do what you guys are doing, then people just go like, well, you're dumb like me. Come on in. Like, jump in the pool. You're one of us now. Good luck.
Yeah. That's what this podcast started for. You know, like, hey, oh, you want to do this? Okay. I'm going to be as realistic about it as possible. But, you know, and give you as many tools as I possibly can. Because one, the more the merrier. Like, my job isn't threatened because you exist. You know, like, there's always going to be people who want maps, are going to want them in a different style than I create, or going to want something specific. Like, I have never felt like any other cartographer or fantasy artist is a competitor of mine. One, because we all do our own thing. You know, I never feel like I'm competing with anyone else. But I genuinely understand that there's a lot of work out there.
Yeah.
Or not a lot of work, excuse me.
But the general vibe of being in the fantasy art community is it's kind of like being part of a mutual aid society. Like, it's the most helpful, supportive group of professionals that I know of. Mm-hmm. My experience is pretty limited to like art and art industries, but most people in this industry want to help other artists improve their craft and improve their business and improve their prospects. Like, we all want to help each other get better and help one another get further down the path that they're trying to go down. And that's one of my absolute favorite things about this industry.
So I have a question going back to what you stated before, that you transitioned from digital to traditional. How hard was it for you? How easy? How long do you feel it took you? Like,
so my background is working traditionally as, like I said, I wanted to become a comic book artist. So I did a lot of pencil and ink work, and I dabbled with, you know, like watercolors or acrylics here and there. When I decided to start making time to like learn how to paint traditionally, I started out doing sort of a hybrid thing where I would do digital underpainting, basically, where I would do my drawing, get my figures all worked out, and get the base rendering, just the shading and stuff sorted right. out. And then I would get my painting surface, and I would prepare it like with like a gessoed artboard.
Right.
And then I would take the file. There's a printer near my house. There's a thing called a UV flatbed printer where another artist had told me about. It's a thing where they can print. They're huge. They could print like the size of a door. And on whatever, as long as it's thin enough, whatever flat surface you give them. So, it's not a regular ink that they use. It's actually, it's almost like an acrylic ink. It's not acrylic. I can't think of what it's made out of right now, but it's like a plastic that gets sealed onto the surface with a UV light. So it's totally inert. So you can paint over that easily. So that was my, which that process, that was, so it was the same process that I was using digitally at the time, where I would do my underpainting. So it was during my first two or three steps of a illustration, I would still do that digitally, but then I would print it out and then do the remaining steps in oil. And I would have like a good like digital sketch to use as reference for like, this is where I want to take it. The biggest stumbling block or like the hurdle that I encountered while I was transitioning over to oils was learning about oils themselves and all the various mediums. It's so intimidating before you start doing it. It felt like alchemy to me. Like, you know, everybody has a little different recipe for what they like. And
why did you choose oils over acrylics?
Because all of my favorite traditional painters were working in oils. So I thought, for sure, that's what I should be doing. Ironically, only just recently, like in the last year, I started doing more work with acrylics, where I've got some magic cards that aren't out yet that I sat down to start doing them, and I went, okay, I'm just going to take it as far as I can with acrylics, and then I'll finish them in oils, which is like a common thing, like to do the underpainting with the acrylics and then do another layer or two with oils. And I had a couple that I finished. I finished with my acrylic step and I went, I really think that's done. Like I just left it. So I have a couple that are straight acrylics. And then I had a few after that I did as acrylics and oils combined. And that's finally
dry. Sorry.
well, that's the so this method of working where it's, so I'm basically doing like 80% acrylics now and then 20% oils. It's the first time since I made this switch over where I don't feel like I'm fighting with the materials in order to get the results that I want.
Yeah.
So there's been a lot of hours of me like painting in oils, and I still don't feel like I have a mastery of those materials. I have like a journeyman's understanding of how all of that works. And so there's a lot of hours of me like gritting my teeth and sweating as I'm trying not to screw up this painting. You know, that I have to turn into a publisher, and I want to, you know, the clock is ticking, the deadline is approaching, and, you know, it was a bit stressful, but now doing this like 80% acrylic approach, boy, you know what's nice is being able to rest your hand on the painting.
Yes.
so good.
With my traditional art, I did a lot of, well, I did a lot of landscapes, a lot of surreal, everything else. But I started off using ink. And then I, too, was like, I should do oil paintings because that's what everyone else does. And, you know, that's what all the masters do. And that didn't last nearly as long because the moment I realized that I could just work with acrylics and do a lot. And this isn't bashing oils at all. They are a lot of fun to play with, but they are very hard to master. And I don't know. I liked the far more dried, quicker, could work with, could paint over of acrylics that I couldn't quite get with oils. So that's why I asked. I'm like, I'm all about acrylic paint.
That's where I finally landed. It took me a long time. Like, and I tried acrylic really before doing the oils, and I didn't get results that I was happy with, but that was because I didn't have a good understanding of like the foundational elements of applying paint in an organized manner.
Yeah.
That's the thing with the traditional, for me anyway, I need to be slightly more organized in my approach than when I was working digitally, because digitally is it's eternally forgiving. Because you have undo, or you have the ability to erase 100% or paint over 100%. You know, traditional media, you can make that stuff happen, but it's a lot harder.
Right. So. See, that's one of the reasons why I actually liked, when I started switching over from traditional to digital, what I liked, the fact of how much acrylic work that I had done, because acrylics are done in layers, because it's oil you can mix on the canvas, which does make it harder because it means that you could screw something up tremendously because you don't realize the undercoat's not dry enough or it's not quite the right color and two colors mesh wrong. With acrylics, that doesn't really happen as much, but it's absolutely, it has to be done in layers, but you have to be very organized about it, know what you're putting each color on a layer.
Yeah.
So when I went over to digital, I was like, oh, it's the same thing. Oh, that's,
oh, there's,
that's,
there's
some
literally reason. Layers.
Yeah, I was like, oh, I can do that.
You know? Yeah.
It did make going over to traditional a lot easier, but
oh, and the other thing that was really fascinating about making that switch, so I would bounce back and forth. I would do digital, and then I would do a traditional piece. You know, every time I would finish an oil painting and then jump back to digital painting, like my digital painting was more efficient and stronger.
Right.
Like I just was gaining insights with every traditional piece, and insights that would translate directly to my process of working digitally.
Right.
So yeah, it was like a wonderful feedback loop. So, and it would happen the other way too, where I would think about what I was doing digitally and how I might do that traditionally on my next painting. And I think it's really healthy for art brains to change things up that way.
Oh yeah. I highly recommend learning different mediums, even if it's just for like personal reasons, like, you know, or just for fun, I should say. Like, I know how to do wood burning, which is, oddly enough, actually how this sort of started with me being in the tabletop industry as an artist, because I obviously have been playing for many, many years before that. But my wife was like, you know, I bet you'd really enjoy pyrography. And I was like, who gives a half-blind person a really hot implement? But okay, let's try it. You know,
did you say pyrography?
Yeah, that's what they call it.
Pyrography.
Yeah. And I loved it. It was a lot of fun. It's something that you can only do like outdoors or in a well-ventilated area. So I don't get to do it nearly as much. But I started like burning maps into leather and wood and everything else and just having fun with it. And this immediately was like, everyone in the tabletop industry was like, oh my God, there's a map on leather, you know? And, but every time that I learn another medium, it helps all the previous mediums I've ever tinkered with. And I think that everything just helps improve your art as you go along, even if it's not something that you choose to stick with.
Yeah, I think so too. I think it's just good for your perspective. And honestly, like I get fired up. I start firing on all cylinders when I'm trying a new medium.
Yeah.
Or something I've never done before. I was like, oh, this is cool. What's this going to do? It's like Jack Skellington, like,
what's
going
this?
Into the scene. Yeah. What's this? Like, oh, the same thing. Like, and I feel like I work a lot. I work probably an unhealthy amount.
Yeah.
But I'm pretty sure that the fact that I do change up the medium that I'm working in or the process that I'm working in helps prevent me from getting burned out.
Right.
Because the projects are different and the needs are different and the process is different. So it's not quite the same thing all the time. It's tough. I'm sure you know, it gets hard when you're like, all right, I've got a dozen maps lined up to do or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, and you just cry a little inside. Like, when will I see daylight again?
Right. Oh yeah. Yeah. It's actually one of the reasons why I will never not love creating maps, but it's the story aspect more than the art aspect of it. For artistic projects and stuff, I think the things that I love most are, you know, it's doing paintings and sketching. I love to sketch. I'm a huge pencil sketch artist, and I love to just doodle randomly. And one day I'm actually going to, like, do it with purpose. But I don't really share those because I'm just like, it's not really what anyone knows me for. And some of them are just, it's just me studying art.
I think there's really something really positive to be said about doing art just for the sake of doing art with no other yes. goal in mind. Like,
right.
I'm just going to do this thing because it feels good. Like, right. is.
Exactly. Well, and I also do it specifically where I'm like, even if I'm like really proud of it, I don't show it on the internet, which I'm sure there's a lot of other artists that are like, why not? You know, everything helps kind of like build your brand and help you become an artist, blah, blah, blah. I don't do it because the moment that I start sharing these drawings, I will start thinking about what I'm drawing specifically to share on the internet. And I don't want to do that. You know, it is purely because I am learning something, because I'm having fun doing it. If there ever comes a day where this changes, sure, great. But for right now, as long as I don't want to ever make it where not everything needs to be content, you know, it's also one of the reasons why I don't stream my art, because I feel really uncomfortable with tons of people watching me create, because I just want to sit there, zone out and play. Not try and read chat or pay attention or answer questions or give cartography classes while I'm
yeah.
in the middle of working.
I did streaming for just a minute just to try it out.
Yeah.
The thing that I was surprised at as a big upside to, you know, counterbalance the stressful things you just mentioned was I got more work done in a shorter amount of time. Because I had to stay focused 100% of the time. It's like, right. Oh, there's people watching. I have to keep working.
Keep drawing, so, yeah.
Yeah, so that was a happy surprise.
See, now I'm just great on that by myself. I don't need the cameras for that.
Well, there you go. I go back and forth about being good at being focused and needing a reminder.
Now, I put on a pair of headphones and... easily, I mean, I have a timer set to remind me to stop, to get up, to stretch and move and everything else, or I will stay pretty much drawing for a good 5 to 6 hours every day without ever stopping.
Yeah, I'm like that once all the references gathered and it's just like, and the drawing is figured out and it's just rendering time.
Right.
Like, and I can get lost in that for forever. And actually, I think I got from you several years ago some good links for some ambient music to put on while I'm
yeah.
working.
Still use those. They're one of my favorite websites to use, and because I get to customize it to exactly what I want. Yeah, that's ambientmixer.com or ambient-mixer.com, I think it is.
Yeah, yeah, I used that one. I had a good one that I like. It's called Loki's Fireplace.
Nice.
It was pretty good. It was just one that they had uploaded, but it was like, it's very chill. Like, you know, it's crackling fireplace. You can hear like scratching of somebody writing and then pages turning every once in a while.
Yeah.
Very good. But
yeah,
I'm all about like trying to create an environment that will allow my brain to have the most success creativity wise.
Yeah.
Which is a thing I think when you're starting, people don't give enough weight to, is to like creating that space for your brain to work well and do the work, I think is really important.
Oh, absolutely. I think one of the best things that we can do for ourselves as artists is to make a creative space just for us, whether it's at your computer or a room by yourself, or I am constantly surrounded by toys, which sounds like it would be distracting, but it's actually really not. Because I get super fidgety and I can draw with one hand and I fidget with the other. I end up rolling a lot of dice. So I keep dice on my desk and I do.
Nice.
And I keep a lot of like fun little reminders of one, my community. They occasionally send me gifts and stuff like that, which I love to have around me because they're very inspiring. And I
love that.
Yeah, I think it's one of my favorite things. Like, I don't think that they realize how much all of their stuff that they've sent to me means to me, and how I have like an entire little shelf on the wall and everything in my office that has everything that I can squeeze on there that someone has sent me, and I gotta expand my shelves. And how much I actually like every day. I end up playing with one of them or, you know, I take them down, dust them off. And I know everybody who's ever sent me where they are, who they are.
And that's from like your Discord, from your Discord community. That's awesome.
They're amazing. I've never, and I'm a part of like numerous other Discords, or at least I was at one point. I narrowed them down quite some time ago because I was getting a little overwhelmed with socials, and but I'm always, every once in a while I join another Discord and I watch all of the drama that goes on, and I'm like, wow, I'm so happy with mine because we're so nice and like supportive. And they're great, they're the best.
There's a couple Discord servers I'm on that I just have to mute often. And then I got a couple that I really really treasure. Like, this is a really good space. Dig it.
Exactly, you know, and we're always doing new stuff on there, so.
Well, I think it's great that you have, like, a community like that to be a part of. That's one thing I think a lot of artists may not be prepared for the lifestyle of being a freelance illustrator, is honestly just how isolating it is. Because it is. It is a lot of time sitting in a room by yourself. That's my happy place, so I am fine with that. But
same.
But it's not for everybody. So I think that's one of the hardest parts.
There's a sociological. I forgot the phrase, but it's basically contact proximity, which means that the majority of people need to be within contact proximity of other people in order to not feel genuinely lonely, or to not feel alone, or to feel like they know somebody. And it's so interesting to me because I do not feel that at all. Like, there, most of the time, my wife comes home and she works a job where she deals with the general public and everything else. And she'll come home and she's just like, oh man, I'm so peopled out. And I'm like, man, I hear you. And I'm the one who's home alone all day. You end up talking to so many people on an average day, or dealing with socials. And if you have a Discord and all the projects that you work on, like, you end up being very sociable as far as online goes. But if you can't, if being home by yourself or in a room by yourself, even if you're being somewhat social on the internet, doesn't work for you, don't work that way. You can rent spaces where you can work with other people. There's a lot of other ways to still be a freelancer, not necessarily work for a company, and still work in a more public place and not isolate yourself, because it does make it really, really hard. And it's very lonely.
Yeah. And I actually have a studio outside of my house that I share with somebody. Yeah. But even like when it's work time, we don't really interact. We just sit.
Right.
But but there is somebody in the room. So if you're like ready for a quick break and want to talk about comics or movies or lunch or whatever, that's a thing that can be done. So that's a really nice support to have there.
Nice. Are they also the same type of art that you do, or do they do something entirely different?
So my studio mate is a storyboard artist for animation. He used to be in-house working on at Warner Brothers. So he worked on Batman the Animated Series, Batman Beyond, Justice League, stuff like that. And then he did a bunch of stuff for Ice Age, or Blue Sky, I think, is the company that did Ice Age. They're not a company anymore, but...
Gotcha.
Yeah, so, and he even got me into storyboarding for a little while. So I did storyboards for Legion of Superheroes for a season, and for... Wolverine and the X-Men, and Avengers Earth's Mightiest Heroes. Nice. And yeah, I won't be doing that again. Animation storyboards is the hardest thing I've ever done.
Really? Why?
It's so much labor. It's like, we would do a board, and this is we were doing them traditionally, so it was just ink on paper, and we would have to do storyboards for like 7 minutes, 6 to 7 minutes of script. And it would end up being like 600 drawings.
Oh my God.
Which is, yeah, it's so much. It's so much. And I'm not a trained animator, so I would have to do things, you know, more than once.
Right.
I would get revisions, and I would have to redraw a bunch of stuff. So it was, in addition to being physically challenging, it was emotionally very difficult to get told that, you know, you're not quite doing it right. So
right.
Do it again. So that was, he's a workhorse though. He makes it look easy. So he's been doing that for 25 years now. And I admire it, but I don't want to do it anymore.
Right. I don't blame you in the least. that's a lot.
Also, you never get to finish anything. Everything, because it is so fast, so you don't get to do like a finished image.
Oh,
I'm like,
yeah, no.
I want to render it, and put, you know, line
right.
weights in there and stuff. Like, no, next drawing. Like, let's go.
Yeah, okay. No, I'd pass on that too. I need to finish my drawings. I need to feel like they're
the good
completed.
Part.
Yeah.
Yeah. Adam's whole thing is he just wants to get the idea down, and like once that's done, he's lost interest. I'm like, oh,
right.
Well, I'll finish that. I'll finish that for you.
Give it to you. Mine. It's mine. So how do you get your art from canvas back to digital once it's done?
Oh, this is the worst part. So the place that's near me that can do the large printing, they have a large scanner. However, with my oil paintings, anyway, I haven't tried it with the acrylic stuff. But with my oil paintings, I ended up using a lot of like transparent colors. I think don't really scan all that
nope.
well.
No, they don't.
So when I got scans, I went, oh, that was like, and it's really expensive to scan a painting for whatever
yes.
reason. It's like $80 or whatever for, you know. The 5 minutes for them to scan it. I had to learn how to photograph paintings, which is
oh, isn't that
not
fun?
No,
I know,
terrible.
I know.
So I went to, do you know who Jeff Miracola is?
The name sounds familiar.
He's phenomenal. He's got a great YouTube channel, so folks could check that out. He's a magic painter that's been around for a long time, and he hosts the Fantasy Art Illustration Workshop, which is a week-long awesome workshop that has some really great instructors and stuff. Aaron Miller is a magic painter who's one of the instructors. Howard Lyon, Steve Prescott. Anyway, Aaron, 2 years ago, he did a demo on how to photograph paintings for illustration, and boy, did that solve a lot of problems. There's some tricks to it that I was missing. So you have to have filters on your lights, polarized filters on your lights,
mm-hmm.
and then you have to have a polarized filter on your lens cap, which I had. And I had had for like 2 years. Right. What I did not know was that you need to spin the polarized filter in order to get it to line up properly and make all of the reflections disappear.
Yeah. For those that don't know, whenever you photograph any, technically oil and or acrylic, every surface has a reflection that your camera picks up that changes the color of your painting. Whenever you're photographing a painting, it does not look like it does in person. And obviously, as artists, we don't want that.
Like, more than that, it would even put, you get reflections on just the brush strokes.
Yeah, that's what I mean. That's the surface of it.
It would look like there's little sparkles all over the whole thing. There's just these little white flecks of light. But when you use the polarized lens and you know how to use it properly, you turn it until all of those reflected points of light don't show up anymore. So, and then there's a way in Photoshop to be able to make sure your painting is all squared properly and you can stitch together. So I need to get a newer camera. Mine is older, so I have to photograph my paintings in pieces and stitch them together, which is automated by Photoshop, so that process isn't too painful. Once you learn how to do it, it's really not too hard.
Yeah, but I mean, 20, 30 years ago, when I was schlepping around all my paintings, photos of them, Photoshop wasn't a thing like it is now. Like, it was so much work. It was so much work.
Yeah, I would. So if it wasn't as easy as it is with those tools being available, I would definitely hire a professional photographer to do it.
Yeah.
And my studio happens to be in a building that has a lot of artists in it. And there are photographers in the building that could do that for me, but it's just easier for me to do it myself at this
point. Photographing my paintings is actually what got me into photography and one of the reasons why I'm actually fairly good at it.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, because I had to figure out, like, how do you... Because there's so much surface area in every painting. I think technically acrylic's more than oil simply because it's thicker and because it's like a plastic, so it does have a far more reflective than oil does. But once you add any finishing to an oil painting, it is so reflective.
Yeah, I was actually spraying my stuff with a matte medium spray to try and make it so that I can scan them in, and it still, that was not cutting it.
So I
don't like doing it, but at the end I'm like, okay, I'll spend an hour photographing this and stitching it together and it's fine.
Right.
It works. The alternative is for magic anyway, they have an in-house photographer, so I could always ship my paintings directly to them.
Oh god.
And then they would photograph it, but I don't want that because sometimes I want to make changes and edits and stuff
right
on my own. So
the other thing is, it's terrifying to ship your paintings.
Yeah.
And very expensive. even if you take it off the wood framework and you can roll it up and everything else, it is still very expensive to ship a painting.
Yeah, I have like expensive shipping crates that I use. But yep. my stuff is all done on illustration board, so it's not too bad. It's more the risk of it A, getting lost, or B, I know somebody who had a painting that they shipped to Dragon Con, and on the way there it got like run through with a forklift, and it was in a wooden crate, and it went through the wooden crate and through the painting and out the other side, which seems like that's probably a rare occurrence, but still it's in my brain now as a possibility.
Exactly. You know, and with all the time that you put into a painting, like, no. I wouldn't handle it very well. I know that. How big are the paintings that you do make, though?
It depends on the piece. Anymore, when I started working with acrylics, I started working smaller because it was one of the things I was struggling with oils was, like, being able to do any detail work. Like, I haven't figured out a good way to get a flow out of the pigments that I like. Whereas with acrylic, you can just make sure there's enough water in there, but not too much. And it's like working with ink, right? You can get nice, tight little lines with a watercolor brush. Get a nice point on it. Just get in there. So usually my last few have been pretty small. I've been doing like 12 by 16. 16 by 20 if I know it's going to be in oils. But yeah, the acrylics I do 12 by 16.
Yeah, most of the paintings I did are about 36 by 24.
Yeah, those are big.
Yeah, that's why I'm like, my paintings were ridiculous to ship.
I've done two that.
Oh, mine are. The largest I've ever done is 6 feet by 4 feet. I used to love to
work on huge canvas. Was that for a client? Or?
No, this was for a series I painted eons ago. And again, one day I'll actually, you know, one of the reasons that I'm doing some of the projects that I am now is so I can kind of get back to some of the other work that I did. One, because I have so many people that are curious about it. And I have a really, I was given some fantastic advice when I very first started creating, which was to never look back. It is one thing to want to learn from mistakes or things that you've done, but if you're going to sit there and just stare at your art and constantly critique something that's already done, you're not improving what you're currently doing. So because of that, I didn't keep pictures of my stuff. One, because also my agent
at the time.
I know, right? I'm really bad at that. But my agent at the time had them, and I totally thought that was all I would need, you know, because you don't think about it at that point. You never think like, oh, wow, I'm just absolutely going to need this later on, even though I'm no longer doing that, you know. And I kept some photos, but nothing like my huge portfolio. The other thing is that, unfortunately, what I did keep got destroyed in a flood of my former home years, like 20 years ago. So even what I had kept didn't survive. The other thing is, like, I really enjoyed doing a lot of those, and again, just for me. But some of it I'd like to spark back up again, and now that the internet and the world is very different from when I first started doing my art. Back then, it wasn't exactly all that accepted. And because, you know, people don't like creepy art. But they do now, so we'll see.
They
we'll
do
see
now.
How the world does, yeah. Can we talk a little bit about selling the originals? How do you go about, like, do you just post them online? Are you contacted by people? Do you have auctions? What do you do to sell the originals? Because I know that they're actually a really, really big thing with Magic the Gathering artists.
So for Magic specifically, it's a really active collector community. So they're really organized. So they have a Facebook page where they do auctions for paintings. So, and I have an agent that I work with that her name is Tatiana Dykes, and she represents my stuff, and she'll run those auctions for me. So it's really just putting them up on that Facebook group and letting people bid.
Nice.
So it's a pretty spoiled situation as far as trying to sell paintings.
No, I mean, hey, it works. I mean, you know, and I hate asking like what's the average sell for, because I know that there isn't such a thing, but is there a range?
Yeah. So kind of like the bottom floor for an original seems to be about 1500 okay. up to an average set with a painting that does really well might go for like 7,000 or 8,000 maybe. I have seen the highest that I know for a recent painting, like a recently done painting, was there was a Drizzt Do'Urden Planeswalker card that was painted by Tyler Jacobson that went at auction for $150,000.
That's beautiful.
Yeah. So Tyler's an amazing artist, but he will also tell you the reason it went for that much was because of the character.
Oh, yeah. I mean, but that's true with all art.
And also, like, all the Drizzt, like, all the Todd Lockwood Drizzt book covers, they're all done digitally. So there was collectors that wanted it, and there's really not a lot of original Drizzt paintings to buy.
Do you sell any artwork outside of that? Like originals outside of Magic the Gathering?
Nah, my schedule doesn't really allow for me to do a whole lot. I've done like some of my comic book work. I did one of the Critical Role comics I did. I did traditional pencils for that. So I had those to sell. But like most of my non-magic stuff is basically me squeezing that work in between magic assignments and between conventions. So that usually all gets done digitally.
Are you going to conventions to sell stuff, to sign stuff, just as a magic artist for yourself, not even having a booth, or like, why are you going?
So I've been doing comic conventions like as long as I've, like before I was getting paying work, I was doing comic conventions. I would set up a table in Artist Alley. Honestly, like right out of high school, I figured out they used to give, Wizard World, Chicago, you could buy a Artist Alley table that came with four badges for cheaper than you could buy four passes for the weekend.
Yes.
So we would do that. I would buy a table and then give the extra badges to my friends. And then we would sometimes sit at the table and sometimes not. So that's not how things are structured now, but
no,
a million years ago. But I've been, you know, taking art to comic book conventions for a long time to like try and sell prints and try and find some work opportunities. So now later in my career, still doing comic book conventions. And it's kind of the same thing. Like I'm there to sell prints and stickers and whatnot and sign. If it's a magic event, then that's more about like signing people's cards and stuff. Comic conventions, more of a, my problem is, as an artist, I do lots of different things. I've got multiple styles that I work in.
Yeah.
So it's hard for me to show up at a convention and like present just one voice, because I do everything from, I do cel shaded work and I do fully painted stuff and I do digitally painted stuff. So, I try to show up with all of those voices. So, when I work at a comic convention, when I table at one, I have to, do the work to connect with the fans that stop by. And, you know, at this point I have a lot of people that are stopping by because of magic or because of
my Critical Role stuff. So
right.
That does a lot of the heavy lifting, but that's a fairly recent thing. So I'm still used to like going and having to talk to people and, you know, tell them who I am, what I do, show them what I have available, and, you know, just chat with them and hopefully go home with more money than I spent to get there.
Right. That's always the hard part. That's always the unknown. So we talk a lot on this podcast about how no one gig ever sets you for life. And I get a lot of people as well. You know, I've had quite a few other Critical Role artists on here with me. And we all talk about how there's this assumption that once you work or have your work shown with Critical Role, then you pretty much have everyone knocking down your door and throwing money at you.
Yeah, that's not been my experience.
That's not been any of our experiences.
Here's the thing I like about doing Critical Role art is the fans that I have met through Critical Role are the best.
Yeah.
They're like super kind and super supportive. And I don't know. It's just fun geeking out with them at shows.
Absolutely. So your experience hasn't been that you suddenly make 6 figures a year and never have to ask anyone for work?
I don't have to really ask for work very often anymore, but that's Critical Role is a part of that, but that's not the main part of it. It's just like years of, you know, I hate the term networking, but like connecting with people, and I don't know, I'm fairly established with enough art directors at this point that every once in a while I have like a gap in my schedule and
you don't know what to do with yourself.
Yeah, I fill it. Like I email somebody and go, hey, I got a gap in my schedule. So, right. But that doesn't happen very often anymore.
Right.
I'm more at a point now that it's when I hear about a project coming up that I want to be a part of, that I will email the people involved with that and see if I can get on it.
Yeah.
And sometimes that works and sometimes it doesn't. But it's cool when it does.
Yeah.
Ooh, do you want to hear about a cool one that did not work out?
Yeah.
So as we're recording this, this is the launch day for the X-Men 97 animated series on Disney Plus. So I actually got hired by Marvel as a character designer for that show for like 2 weeks. I was brought on to test out to become a full-time character designer for it. It was down to me and one other person, and they ended up going with the other person. So that was my road not traveled.
Oh.
I was this close. And I wasn't even going to have to move because they were like hiring people remotely. So I was going to be able to get that, and then I was really excited about maybe like going out to LA a couple of times a year and like working in the studio for a week.
But right.
Didn't work out, but I got a lot of opportunities as a freelancer that I would not have gotten if that had worked out. So yeah. There's no sour grapes around it. If I wasn't the right person for the job, then I'm glad that, I mean, it's better to be working on stuff where people appreciate you than to like constantly be trying to convince them that you're the right person for the job.
Right. Right. That has a lot to do with like imposter syndrome that a lot of artists feel, especially in this space.
I still get that sometimes.
I don't know anyone who doesn't. Yeah. Like I do. I very rarely get it because I don't ever feel like, I always make the joke that I have enough confidence to like for an entire village of people. And because I have done so much traditional work and everything else, and I've basically been being an artist in some form or another since I've been about 17 years old, there's no part of me that's like, I don't deserve this. You know, like I've worked my ass off, you know, to be here type of thing. So, but I occasionally get very like, oh, wow. you know, like, not that I feel like I'm being excluded, but I feel like I'm on the outside. You know, like, I feel like I watch a lot of other people kind of group together and hang out and have a great time. And I'm not involved in that in any way. And then I'm always like, wow, am I more on the outside than I realize? Why aren't I invited? You know, like, that's the closest I kind of get to.
You know what does it for me every once in a while, Devin? Mm-hmm. It's these damn kids. So when you and I were coming up, like, there wasn't YouTube, right. the internet was barely a thing. So we were trying to figure out how to do what we wanted to do by looking at, you know, stuff in print and mm-hmm. trying to maybe find a book or like a good instructor that could help us. And man, I'm so impressed with all of the artwork that I see coming from
right.
young artists that have grown up with YouTube as just part of their, you know, their daily life. And they have all the access to all these amazing tutorials and stuff. I was hanging out on message boards and like posting stuff and reading tutorials that were typed out, like, do this, then do this, then do this, and step by step.
Ruining canvases after canvas because I have no one that can help me figure this out. Yeah, absolutely.
So I'll see somebody that is doing work that I'm like, man, I hope I'm that good someday. How old are you? Oh, you're 21. Sweet. That's awesome. So then I might trigger a little imposter syndrome. Like, man, I hope these kids don't see that I'm actually not very good at my job.
You are amazing at your job. You wouldn't be this booked otherwise, and you know that.
I feel, most of the time, I feel comfortable where I'm at, but yeah. It's just, boy.
Just every once in a while, it's like, man.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, because I sit there and think every once in a while, like, if I had had access to even half of the information that they do right now, I can't imagine where I would be artistically now. A perfect example is when I transitioned over to digital, I immediately went to Photoshop because I did photography. I already knew Photoshop. So yeah, of course I can, you know. Everyone's like, you should try Procreate. You should try Clip Studio Paint. You should, like, all of these other software. And I kept trying to dabble in them, but like, I don't know any of this. I can't figure this out. Everyone's telling me to make brushes. How the fuck do you make a brush?
That's where my brain fogs over. I'm like, you're right. I should learn to make brushes. But right. Look at all these brushes that are already in here. I'll just use those.
Right. Well, that's where I started. I started learning with the brushes that were already there. And it's funny because in Photoshop, I used two brushes, one to draw with, one to paint with. And that was it. And everyone's like, what do you mean? How do you only draw with two brushes? I'm like, I don't know. How do you only draw with one pencil? Like, I don't understand what you're asking me. You don't understand. I literally am drawing digitally like I would on a piece of paper because I don't know how to make digital art.
That's how I learned.
Right. You know, exactly. And then Kate May, who I've had on here, who I just adore, was so gracious. Oh yeah, she's such the best. She was so gracious with her time and was like, I'll help you. And like genuinely sat down and explained how digital, especially with Clip Studio Paint, because I wanted to get rid of Photoshop. I don't like their business model. I don't like having to how expensive it is. And I wanted, it doesn't have the variety I want artistically. And I didn't want Procreate because I wanted something that I could use on my computer because I have a Wacom tablet. And I can't really draw on my iPad as easily. One, it's too small. I like a nice big canvas. And I can't lean on it at all. And I kind of need to because I am partially blind and I sit very close to my monitor. I needed to zoom way the fuck in.
So are you working in Clip Studio mostly?
Yeah, I now exclusively work in Clip Studio Paint.
Man, I could have sent you a CSP file.
Oh, it doesn't matter. Yep. Clip Studio reads Photoshop.
Yeah, I know, but I work all, I'm all Clip Studio, so all of my native files are CSP files, and I'm just reflexively, when people say, "Can you send that to me?" I go, "Yep," and I'll just convert it over to Photoshop format.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's what everyone asks.
Everybody can open that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it, for all of you want to freelance artists that want to start working with other companies, by the way, they actually want you to send them everything in Photoshop files, which is super annoying when you don't use Photoshop. But Clip Studio Paint will save your files in layers in Photoshop format. So you don't need to have Photoshop and still send them Photoshop files.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Little tip there. But yeah, so Kate showed me how to create them, and I've been slowly, like, in my quote-unquote free time, I've been learning how to create assets and make brushes. One, because there's some things that I do so repetitively, it would be great to do in a brush, but I notice patterns really, really quickly, so that makes me very hesitant. But I'm learning. And the other thing is I found that I could make my own stippling brushes and my own pencil brushes that mimic what I normally do on paper so much better than other, not to say like other people's brushes aren't as good, but they're, you know, when you're an artist, you have your favorite.
Yeah.
You know, like your favorite pencil, your favorite brush, or like there's just something about it. So I had to learn how to do that digitally, and I love it now. Like, I am having a field day learning how to make these things.
Yeah, Clip Studio Paint is so powerful.
Yeah.
For what it can do. I was using it. I was so used to working in Photoshop. And I also used Corel Painter for a number of years because their watercolor brushes are so good.
I know.
But with Clip Studio Paint, I used it just like I was using Photoshop for years. And then, like a year ago, I discovered how good the vector layers are, and it changed my life.
I haven't gotten into vector layers yet. I don't know. I don't even know how to use them with what I do.
Oh yeah, Devin, you have to try it, because it's not like in Photoshop. If you do a vector, whatever, and it gives you like the splines and the blobbity blahs, and it's, all technical and confusing. In Clip Studio, it's the same as a raster layer, except for you can grab things and rescale them infinitely. Like,
no.
There's no difference. It's just drawing. It's amazing. Change your life.
We're going to have to talk about this when we're not doing a podcast, because everyone's going to be like, what? Because I'm going to ask you to show me this. Because, I'm blown away. Although I am going to say, as someone who did so much traditional work before, there's software out there called Rebelle. It's R-E-B-E-L-L-E, I think it is. It is the closest, other than Corel Paint, that I've seen to actually traditional paint. It is an amazing software that really genuinely reacts as close to paint as I've seen something digitally, other than, again, Corel Paint's just phenomenal, but is ridiculously expensive. And, you know,
it is pretty expensive.
Yeah. But Rebelle is actually fairly inexpensive. And it's also, I found it because I have a friend who does some of the most amazing watercolors I've ever seen. And she started working digitally. She now exclusively works in the software, and it looks exactly like her regular paintings, which is mind blowing to me, because, you know, how? It's fucking magic, you know?
I mean, if it looks just the same, I'm like, I wish it was just a painting.
Right. Like, well, I mean, she has specific reasons why. Yeah. I mean, there's reasons why. So I went over from traditional to digital. One, because the stuff that I work with, as far as maps were concerned, of course, everyone wants them digitally and scanning and piecing everything together like I did my normal paintings. Started getting a little tiresome, especially when it came to maps. But also, because I am immune compromised, the cleanup for doing traditional artwork is kind of toxic for people like me. So I tend to, like, even though acrylics can mostly be cleaned up with waters, you know, water, soap and water, oils and stuff like that can't be. So, and that and the fact of, like, it's really expensive to paint on canvas. And even though technically you should make it back when you sell the painting, sometimes, you know, when you're like me and can't be there for gallery showings anymore and can't schlep your stuff around, and traditional art, as far as selling canvas work, is still very so hands-on. It doesn't really work when you're immune compromised.
Yeah, that makes sense. And it's also for client work, being able to make changes digitally is real good.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. With maps especially, I was like, I cannot do this traditionally. It's not going to work. People would endlessly accidentally give me something misspelled. And I was like, well, I burned it into leather. That's the new spelling of it. I'm sorry. There's no erasing leather.
Yeah. You just cross it out.
And right.
Go again.
Yeah. You know, and there's lots of things like that. Because I make prop maps. And once you apply water to the type of paper that I use, every mark you make on it is there permanently. So there is no erase. And it is a not a forgiving process at all. So you better make sure that you have everything exactly where you want it to be. So there are no edits once you start putting it on the paper. So yeah, I'd like to do that digitally so I could erase things and retype things.
And,
I,
and that happens with my oil paintings. Like if I get changes from my art director on a traditional painting, then I have to either be able to make the changes to the physical painting, or it's much easier to just do it digitally. And then
when
I sell the painting, sometimes it's a selling point. Sometimes it's a detraction. So kind of depends on the piece and the collector. So,
right. Can you sell the variants any?
Well, I mean, if I do a piece and I turn in my final painting and they say, well, we wanted change the costume to be this color.
Right.
That's a very extreme example. Usually it's something more nuanced, like, oh, if the expression was a little bit different on this face, for example. I make the decision based on what my schedule looks like. If I have the time to do it traditionally, I'll do it traditionally. If I don't have time, and then I'll do it digitally. And then, so if the final painting I sell is different than the published piece, then yeah, I can still sell that.
As always, our show is sponsored by Legend Keeper, a fantastic world-building tool, whether you're a writer, a GM, DM, or even a player. You can create a world, you can add all of your notes, you can determine who gets to see them, edit them, create their own. And if you own a project, you are the only person who has to have a subscription, so you can bring your players in for free, or your readers, or your patrons. You can determine who can edit, who can see, who can view secrets. And there are so many really interesting tools on Legend Keeper that allow you to link pages, maps, images, sidebars, timelines, calendars, like you name it. There is so much about Legend Keeper that is so simple and yet incredibly effective. This technically isn't the first time that I've tried to do a podcast. I had been asked...
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah, no, I had one before. And it didn't go anywhere. Part of that is because I had been asked a bunch of questions and it was just me and I was just spewing out the information because I was trying to answer the questions. And I realized like that isn't going to work with a bunch of very creative people. That's not how they want to take in information. So I was like, all right, well, if I ever actually have the time to do a genuine podcast and bring other people in and get other experiences than just my own and not just me sitting there talking to a mic, that'll be different. But that was years ago. So now I'm like, all right, we'll try this again and see what happens.
How's it going so far?
I don't know.
Perfect.
Yeah, no. So what I did was when I first started, it was supposed to be about world building and map making and stuff. But that's within like the first recording. That's not how that was going. And I realized that I don't actually care how good it does. I care about being able to talk to people, being able to hang out, and hopefully being able to give some insight into what it's like, one, being an artist in this space. I am trying my best to build sympathy for artists so we aren't immediately looked over when it comes to AI, that we are given more chances to actually be creative and have more say in like the pay that we get or the contracts that we work on, instead of just being handed something by wizards and being told, well, that's just what we do. So, you know, I realize that there's, I'm building an audience. I'm getting a lot more response. So I'm just going to take it instead of looking at any numbers. I'm just going to take it as in, okay, so I have people that comment and that ask questions. And the more people that do that, obviously the better it's doing. And if I have 10 people listening, that's fine. But it's more than that. I'm just terrified to look at the numbers, if I'm going to be honest.
I think that's a really healthy attitude when we're talking about drawing something just for the sake of drawing something. You know, this is also a creative endeavor. And if you're not financially dependent on a specific result from that creative endeavor, then you can just focus on just making the thing because it brings you joy to make the thing.
Exactly. This, oddly enough, has a financial benefit to it, which I wasn't intending, which is really funny to me. Even though, so when I give advice to other people and I talk about their careers or building a brand, I always talk about having something that, you know, someone creates that they just feel comfortable, either they're doing it for themselves, but they share it with the community. I always talk about like, having a very relaxed conversation with other people in the industry is the best way to make friends, to make contacts, to build any sort of reputation. Like, you know, just have genuine conversations. Don't try and sell your stuff. Don't, you know, whatever. And inadvertently, that's what I started doing immediately with a podcast and did not realize that I was, because I hadn't intended to build any relationships with it. One, because when I first started, I, of course, was already inviting people I already knew. So, you know, because I thought everyone else would just say no.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Play it safe to start out.
Yeah. You know, I just recently had someone message me. They're like, hey, this is who I am in the industry. This is what I do. I should be on your podcast. Oh, well, then, yeah, come on. People will come to me to be on my podcast. Yes. You know,
Devin, I'll take it.
Right? I'm all famous now. This would be hilarious if this ends up what I do, though.